I still consider myself to be a relative newcomer to this field, so I should apologize up front if I don't give proper credit to work that has been done over the many years that this field has existed. It's not because I'm evil, it's just because I'm ignorant, and you're welcome to correct me and give me information as I go by and miss it. So basically, the outline of my talk here will be, I will try to motivate. I'll actually almost skip that given the good motivations we've gotten this morning, and I don't think this crowd here needs any motivation for studying any of these things. I'll study a little bit about, I'll explain a little bit about the approximations that go into simulations, particle simulations of these types of systems, and what the problems and approximations are that we are encountered with. Then I'll spend some time, and that may actually be quite boring for most of you, but I want to force this point of Lechner summations in periodic media. And there really is very little reason for doing it, except that I think this is a beautiful complementary tool for studying electrostatic interactions in periodic systems. It complements the Ewald summations very nicely, and in my mind it is a slightly more beautiful formalism, but that's of course a subjective statement. In any case, I want to advertise a particular paper that Lechner did in 91 and sort of try to give you an idea of why this is very useful, at least to gain some intuition. And of course it's always useful to have complementary numerical or conceptual tools that would eventually give the same result, which of course it should. Then I'll just discuss briefly what the simulation techniques are and what the model really is when we come down to adding up numbers. And then I will hopefully in the end get to some simulations about what we can do in terms of getting effective interactions between charged macromolecules in counter-ion and salt solution. So we'll deal with some spheres, some rods, and maybe some planes, and then I'll conclude. This table is too little. Put it there. Good idea. Thank you. So, motivation. Why study electrostatics? Of course, we want to understand some biology, why things happen the way they happen when we observe them. Then, once we have done that in a couple of thousand years, we will try to do what is more difficult to some extent, and that is try to change what's happening by making applications, as Sira Safinja also discussed this morning, drug delivery, gene therapy, you know, basically lots of things. There are also technological applications that one can think of. People are making thin films for optical purposes with positive polyelectrolytes absorbing on glass surfaces and things like that. Can make sensors. There's actually quite a bit of an effort in Los Alamos in making sensors in addition to thin films, where these things are basically being driven, or essential parts of the function are consist of electrostatic interactions. And then one could think of making simply new materials, use these things as catalysis, whatever, for making new materials. But the most important thing for me is the 1/r is pretty basic stuff. It is one of the only interactions that we know exists, and obviously it confuses us quite a bit when we dump more than a few particles into a box and see what they do. Since it's charge neutral, it all has cell screening. And that means that there are lots of competing interactions, and it is highly unpredictable, as we all know, what's really going on. And it has a lot of links to other fields, since this interaction is so basic. Vortices in high TC materials could be described very much with the interactions that Rudy Podgornik discussed right before lunch, for example. The pictures almost resemble exactly what people in vortex dynamics and high TC materials would present at one of their talks. Stripe formation and cuprates, Branko Stojković is here, he's done some work on that. That's also very similar, basically competition between interactions on different scales. dislocation dynamics, which again relates to water seas and so on and so forth. So there are lots of reasons for studying these things. Systems we're interested in are, of course, systems that are, as Rudy also showed some pictures of, and Cyrus did too, lots of complicated molecules with lots of covalent structure. They're complicated surfaces, and they bend, and they do all sorts of things in solution, both when we force them to and when we don't. The solvent is quite complicated in itself. There are people spending their entire lives studying water, for example, and the structure in water. It's a very complicated solvent. Temperature affects all of these things in an even more complicated way. It's almost incomprehensible to imagine the complexity of this system in my mind. When we build a model, we typically just say it's all classical. We throw out the water and put in a continuum dielectric constant, turns out, which is the one that we would measure in bulk water. Typically, we'll try to put in ideal geometries, so something that looks flat is perfectly flat, something that looks straight is perfectly straight, something that looks spherical is perfectly spherical. And that's because potentials get easier to deal with that way. We don't really like too many dielectric interfaces. If we have too many dielectric interfaces on curved surfaces, it gets to be a real problem to deal with. So we basically just usually neglect these things, or at least I do. There are always publications here and there where people try to take these things into account, but basically the bulk of the work is to try to eliminate as much of the complication as possible. And temperature is introduced as a simple stochastic parameter. That's building the model. I want to show that. And if we then want to simulate a model like that, well, then we have to define a bunch of particles, and we have to associate each particle with certain number of parameters that will define this particle's nature. Here I have, in green, I assume that we have a big spherical particle with a certain radius, and we have some smaller particles that are red, and one could think that the small red ones were positive ions and the big green ones were negative spherical particles. And for each particle, we simply have an equation of motion like this. This is a mass and the double derivative. We have a friction and the first derivative, and we have an energy surface U, which depends on all the parameters, all the positions in this system here. And then we take a gradient of that energy surface. And that equates then a noise term. And the noise term basically is the term that, to some extent, is replacing all the water that we threw out. So that's where all the thermal effects lie. That's Gaussian noise term, and with the dissipation fluctuation theorem, you know exactly what number to put in as a prefactor to this autocorrelation function so that you get the right temperature. We also, in these systems here, usually throw out the mass term because water, I mean, first of all, we're studying equilibrium, so mass doesn't really matter. And secondly, water is fairly overdamped at these scales. So that looks pretty simple. It's just a single equation for each particle, and we can update that with some time steps, and we can use an Euler method or any other method that we fancy to update time, and thereby evolving this system. And equilibrium is then reached through a lot of time steps. The energy surface is given by two things that I will distinguish throughout what I'm doing. There is the electrostatic contribution here. These are basically just saying that all pairs of interactions are being considered. There's the electrostatic contribution, and there is the contribution from what I call hardcore interactions. And that's simply an interaction that'll come on the next slide. It's just a short-range interaction that'll define sizes and shapes of these objects. So there are two ways to proceed from here. One is to do particle simulations, which I'll be talking about, and then there is to do some analytic theory, which I won't really be talking about, and actually Andrea Liu will talk about that after me, I guess. There. correct me if I'm wrong, but I figure you will. Good. So the analytic theory, you will do a mean field type of treatment of all these small ions that we consider to be microscopic objects relative to the macro objects, some kind of mean field treatment of those. In doing that, we of course lose a lot of the information about correlations, and I believe Andrea will talk about how to build that back in. And something that always confuses me is how charge neutrality is conserved in those kind of treatments. I may be completely off track here, but that is something that confuses me. Then we can do particle simulations, which I will be talking about. The downside here is we can only do very, very small systems. And by doing very small systems, we lose a lot of the degrees of freedom that are present in the true system. In trying to compensate for that error here, we impose periodic boundary conditions, and that's another cause for worry, which I'll be talking about. Yeah. Later. So, the hardcore potential, the short-range interactions, they basically, as I said, just define size and shape, and they prevent disaster. Because we have here particles that carry a non-zero charge, and if we didn't have a finite size of an object, meaning that if this object here was a point object, this particle here being attracted to that electrostatically, the green ones here are negative and the reds are positive, or vice versa, then we would have a Coulomb disaster, of course, just falling into the abyss. So we need something to prevent that from happening. And I use a potential like this. It's basically a modified, shifted Lennard-Jones potential. The standard Lennard-Jones potential has two parameters, a sigma and an epsilon here. So the epsilon is the depth of this potential here. The sigma gives you the zero crossing of the potential. So it's at long range, it is slightly attractive with a 1 over r to the 6. And at short range, it is strongly repulsive with 1 over r to the 12. That's an okay potential, but if you have objects of very different sizes, it is best to think of a big object as being covered with small objects at the surface. So therefore, I'm shifting this thing here with a radius, a hardcore radius. So I'm shifting out this singularity that usually lies at zero, so I'm shifting that out with R0 here. Okay? And then I have my Lennard-Jones potential there. On top of that, what I'm doing is that I'm truncating the potential at its minimum, at the 6th root of 2 times sigma, and I'm doing that not to have any spurious effects in my simulations of the van der Waals attraction. I want to make sure that if I see attraction, it's due to electrostatics and nothing else. Okay? So that's basically the potential we're looking at. It's a purely repulsive thing. It has singularity, which is shifted out from 0, basically to define a real size of an object. No, it is, yeah, right. I'm just trying to illustrate why I'm moving this R-naught. Although I could cover it with particles.
Can you repeat the question in case people didn't...
Oh, yeah. This figure here indicates that I actually have small particles sitting on the surface, but I will assume that it's just a spherical, smooth surface that this red sphere here is interacting with. So that's the short-range part. And that's easy to deal with. I should also mention that if you want to do a Monte Carlo simulation instead of the Langevin type of simulation, which you can just as well do, you don't have to worry about all of this Lennard-Jones stuff. You can just have an infinitely sharp wall sitting somewhere in the system. So that was that one. However, long-range things are slightly different. If we want to simulate a relatively small system, but we're still interested in a bulk small system, I mean the order of 1,000 particles or something like that, which clearly isn't bulk. It's not Avogadro's number yet. But we want to kind of simulate something which is bulk-like. We impose periodic boundary conditions, which I'm sure most of you will know. So if this is the simulation cell here highlighted, in this little box, and we have two particles in this box, then particle 1 is interacting obviously with particle 2. but it is also interacting with all the images of particle 2 in all the other boxes. And that interaction is basically what the Ewald method, the famous Ewald method, has so been so successful in helping us with modeling. The Ewald summation method basically imposes charge neutrality and then sum up the energy. So it puts in a uniform background of charge, because that does not affect the uniform background of countercharge, because that does not affect the force, since it's uniform, so it doesn't change the physics. And once you take that into account, you can then sum everything up, and it's a convergent series, at least conditionally convergent. And then there's Lechner's method, which comes out of a paper from 91, this Physica A paper here, which I think is very good. I think the idea might actually, as usual, everything has been done before. I've seen a paper from 53 now by Krumhansel and his group that have done something very similar. So, but I'm sure I could find another one further back. At some point, gotta stop, and I want to name it the Lechner summation technique. Lechner used his methods to calculate Madelung constants of ionic crystals. And basically what he does is that he doesn't sum the energy, he sums the force, and then integrate later on once he has the summed up force and assume charge neutrality. So he does things in the opposite order of what Ewald does. The nice thing about summing up the force is that there's a lot of symmetry in the force. You can see how it converges a lot easier. You don't have to assume charge neutrality when you sum up the force, because since force has direction, the force coming from this image of particle 2 on particle 1 will almost be canceled by that one out there, because they have opposite direction. Likewise, that one up here will be somewhat canceled by that, and as you go further and further away, just by pure geometry, you can see how forces, the long-range part, will simply cancel by the periodic images. So it's a very intuitive way of looking at it, I think.
Can give you the potential, or only gives you the force? I mean, for what you're doing, if I understand, you only need the force.
I also need the potential. It turns out that the functional form of the force is conveniently integrated into a potential.
So you can get the potential.
Yeah, and fortunately, it actually comes out to give the same value as the Ewald summation, which would be funny otherwise, but it would be somewhat interesting. So my interpretation of this, and Lechner presented his work in a very different way because he had a different purpose with it. But my interpretation, which I'll try to impose on you, is there'll be two or three more of these, and that's why I say most of you will find this boring, but I want to force it upon you. To take a system which is replicated only in one dimension, so you have a string of charged particles two here. This doesn't come very well through on the view graph, but you can see particle number 2 here being replicated in the z direction. You also have a particle number 1 that will interact with all particles number 2. And if we then want to write down what the force is on particle 1 from this string of particles 2, we have the force in the z direction being 1 over the cube of the distance between 1 and any of the 2s. So that's the counter n of the 2s. Lz is the periodicity along this vertical line here. And z here is the distance between 1 and its closest image of 2. Let's see, that shouldn't be a z, that should be an rxy. So this z here is an rxy, okay? This z here, on the other hand, is the z, which is the vertical distance between 1 and 2, okay? And then we multiply with the coordinate of the direction in which the force works. So that's the force in z, and that's the force in x and y. And again, this z here should be an rxy. By the Lechner transformation, which I'll show on the next slide, you can easily convert these two to those two. And I'll show you on the next slide how easy it is. Basically, the result here is that you have this force here being expressed only through these modified Bessel functions. And the trick here with the modified Bessel functions is that they converge exponentially fast. They're incredibly fast convergent, so this series here converges immediately within a few turns, okay, to any machine accuracy you want to. That's very nice. It's basically a Fourier expansion, as you can see, because you have all the signs sitting here. The force in the x and y direction contains the same kind of core, which is summed up here. It's just k1 instead of k0. Doesn't really matter. But then we have this additional term here, which is a long-range term. And when you integrate these, there are simple integration rules, of course, for these modified Bessel functions. If you integrate these two and compare them to each other, then you get your energy surface. Okay? So that's the answer to your question. You have this energy surface, which has a short range. This is all short range due to this k0, a short range complicated part and a long range very simple part, because the long range is simply just the average line charge density interacting with the particle. Well, obviously, that should be a log, and that pops out almost immediately. So that's the energy surface from this type of potential. You can take this energy surface, and you can just replicate. If you take, now you have the interaction between a particle or a string of particles with another string of particles, and you can just replicate that in whatever geometry you want to. You can make a three-dimensional lattice, you can make a two-dimensional lattice, whatever you want to. The only complication now is to sum up this logarithm, okay? But that's even easier. Let me just show you Lechner's transformation, just for the record. There are four mathematical identities. They can all be looked up in Glasstein-Ruzsch, for example, or any other classic type of a formula table like that. You simply apply these in that sequential order. I don't want to go into detail with it because you have to do it, but this is it. It's very beautiful. The logarithm is not here. Logarithm is not here, and that I'll do in a second. That will actually do now. Because as I said, everything except the logarithm is now a short-range part. So we don't worry about that anymore. It's exponentially quickly converging. But if we want to now make a three-dimensional system, periodic system, for example, this little box here, we can take all the columns that we had before and just replicate them in space and let those interact with each other. So the short-range part doesn't matter, so we only need to worry about the logarithm. Now, the logarithm, here we have the force associated with a logarithm, so it's 1 over r squared times the distance in the coordinate of which the force works in x and in y. We have to make this 2D summation, but there is another little identity like this, and you can cast this functional form into that functional form. This z here is a complex number, and bingo, you get expressions like this. Again, these are exponentially fast convergent. They're expressed only in terms of trigonometric functions. And as you can see, this is a two-dimensional summation. This is only a one-dimensional summation. So all the long-range part in the 3D system has now been condensed down to the long-range part, just summed in one dimension. And in fact, you can prove that this thing here will converge to any machine accuracy, 10 to the minus 16, within 8 terms, always, no matter the geometry that you pick. So it's an incredibly beautiful thing, I think, that is generally applicable. And of course, you don't have to make this an orthorhombic lattice. You can make it any stupid lattice you want to. You just have some different little things sitting in here. You can also integrate these things here easily, and you get an expression like that, and that's your energy surface for a logarithmically interacting system. So, having bored you with this, I hope that you will now be enthused enough to go and use it. But basically, what we have done now, again, here we have a system, just a slightly different geometry. We have taken our logarithmic long-range interaction, or 1 over r. I just display a log because it's 2D. It's 2D and therefore easier to show. So the long-range part of this interaction we now replace with a periodic potential. And that's important to keep in mind because when we study small systems, our long-range interactions only exist in terms of periodically reoccurring interactions. So this is the type of energy surface that we're looking at. So we have a case-based truncation once we have periodic boundary conditions. So what can we calculate? And now I'll soon get to some results. But the standard things to calculate are mean forces between macro objects. trying to make statistical averages over all the microobjects, all the ions. We can calculate pressure, stress, shear if we want to, and we can calculate G of R pair distribution functions, and by having the pair distribution function, try to invert that into an effective potential. We can calculate free energies, and I won't do that because I'm just trying to figure out how to do it right now. Basically, there are two different things that you can look at. Interactions between oppositely charged macroobjects, they obviously will always attract each other, unless you put in so much noise that they're blowing apart. Or you can study interactions between light-charged macroobjects. And there, it's a bit of a question mark, because as we know from experiments, it sort of depends on the conditions, what they'll do. So in my mind, that's slightly more interesting, and that's what I'll be talking about, the interactions between light-charged objects, because there is a sign switch to worry about there, and that's a clear enough thing to look for. So the first thing that I will discuss in terms of simulations is a system consisting of charged spheres. And we have to go back to this electrostatic stuff just for a little bit longer, because it turns out that if you break down, let me just see, I forgot to mention something on the last one here, wherever that went. That's the one, thank you. If we want to calculate the pressure, osmotic pressure, pressure of the system, it's of course the volume derivative with respect to the free energy, and you take an average of that and put a minus in front. And the entropic term is always giving this kT times the density of particles. Each particle will carry an energy of kT. And then we have the virial, which I will deliberately split up in two parts. Again, I'll split the hardcore, the short-range part, away from the long-range part. So that's what I'm going to discuss on the next slide. Because each particle is, of course, interacting with another particle. On top of that, it is interacting with itself. So if this is a lattice, this green particle here is interacting with its own image. And it's, in fact, it is interacting with all its own images. And that self-energy, which I call it, and probably also other people will call it, is given by this expression here, obviously. And so that can be easily calculated from the energy surface that we had from before. So the total electrostatic energy is given by a sum of all the interaction energies, Qi, Qj being the charges of the particles, but it also has a contribution from each particle in form of a self-energy, and that's because this thing here is being replicated to infinity in all directions, or in any direction you want to. So that's the total energy. It turns out, and that's of course a general result for any 1 over R type potential, but it turns out if you take the electrostatic contribution to the pressure, which is the derivative of the electrostatic energy with respect to volume, ensemble average and a minus in front, you simply get back to the energy itself. Okay? So that's why we want the energy. That's very important, because that gives us almost directly the electrostatic contribution to the pressure. If you define a zero point for the energy as this integral, you integrate the interaction energy over the entire volume of your box, and you require that to be zero, then this relationship holds. So it's a very important relationship, because it means that we can calculate the pressure contribution from the electrostatic interactions. Otherwise, if we use the standard virial, we need to have a force times an interaction, but we need to have that force times an interaction for all the replica. That would be an insane summation to try to accomplish. So this is very useful. So first, what we do, and this is a little piece of work that I've done together with Phil Pincus and Keith Beardmore, take two spheres and dump them in a little box, and there are periodic boundary conditions. Obviously, concentration here is absolutely essential, and the reason for that is that spheres in infinite dilution cannot hold on to their counter ions. The logarithmic entropic repulsion will always win eventually. So concentration is absolutely essential, otherwise we just see the bare interaction between spheres and they'll be repulsive. So that's what's fun about this system. So we have two spheres in a box. We just take two small spheres, 7 or 8 angstrom in radius. That, with the charge of about 10 unit charges on each sphere, with a minus in front, that leaves a surface charge density of about 1 charge per 62 square angstrom. So it's not completely unrealistic. We take divalent counterions, and then we measure the pair correlation function between, or pair distribution function between these two spheres in the range of distances being less than half the dimension of the box. Okay? Because if we go beyond half the dimension of the box, we'll wrap around and come back at minus 1/2. So that's the maximum distance in our system. This, again, didn't come through very well, but I'm sure you can see it. I take different volumes of the box. This being L half of one, that being L half of another, L half of a third, and so on and so forth. And what you can see is that for all these curves, there definitely is a tendency of creating a minimum at close range. Of course, this is no surprise because the box is so small, this being L half, that almost has no choice. There's no mobility left. But even for a rather dilute system, these systems here are quite dilute. I think this one goes up to 160 cubed, and the spheres only being about 7 or 8 angstroms. You see that you have a long-range repulsion, which is probably very well described by a DLVO-type potential. But if the particles get close to each other, there clearly is a short-range attraction. Okay. And here I have plotted the minimum value of this effective potential here, measured through the pair correlation function, as a function of the volume accessible to the two particles. And you can see that there is a minimum here, and as you increase the volume more and more and more, this minimum disappears. So that basically just says that there is a transition from the close range attraction, from the close range conformation being preferred to the repulsive long range repulsion being preferred as you increase the volume. The other thing is to look at the barrier between going from here out to there. So that's basically looking at the height of this peak here as a function of volume. And you can see that that height is fairly high to begin with, but then it drops off as the system becomes very dilute. And that's again because the two spheres cannot hold on to their counterions. So if they just float around in free space, then these two spheres will always see each other's naked charge, and they will never actually get close enough to create this attraction wherever it comes from. So that was a correlation study of the interaction. Now we can try to look at the pressure and see what that can tell us. As I said before, the pressure we can split into three components: the thermal component, which is just nkt over the volume; a hard core component, which is given by the hard core potential, that's just the standard virial distance times force; and then we have the electrostatic component, which is given by the electrostatic energy, basically. It turns out that the electrostatic energy, if you only look at one sphere, for example, in a box that you replicate to infinity, that the electrostatic energy is negative, because when you only look at one sphere, it is interacting with a neutralizing uniform background. So this is an extreme mean field approximation. And it's given by this number here, minus 1.4 something or rather, over the cubic root of the volume. And then you have to divide with the volume because of the virial thing. So basically, from this expression up here, you have these three terms, and you can see that they all scale differently in a very primitive sense. They all scale differently with volume. So basically, for large volume, if we have a PV diagram, large volume, this term here will always win. It goes the slowest to zero of the three. At very small volumes, when the system is compressed very much, we basically only see the hard core, because that's what you see. Things are banging into each other. And these are both positive contributions to the pressure, because that's the way that I constructed my hard core interaction. But then in the middle, and this scales sort of marginally stronger than the thermal and a lot weaker than the hard core. In the middle, there is the possibility for negative pressure or tensile pressure, or at least for lowering the pressure. So one can see here that we should not be totally surprised if we see spheres confined in a box if they suddenly attract each other, simply because the electrostatic contribution in a primitive sense, extreme mean field, will have a negative pressure contribution, and it scales right in between the two extreme hardcore and thermal contributions. So we can add these numbers up, and if our parameters are right, then we can get this dip, this non-trivial TV diagram. And then we can try to see from a simulation if we can reproduce that. And indeed we can. So this is exactly the same parameter set from before, except that I now just have one sphere in the box, and it's counter ions. There are actually very few counter ions, and I'll comment on that in a little bit when I get to rods. But basically, this is the pressure as it comes out from this calculation versus the concentration. So if we have a very dilute system, we have a small but positive pressure. As we concentrate the system more and more, this pressure suddenly bends over and it becomes tensile. And then eventually here we'll see the hard core of interaction, so it'll go up again. So indeed we have attraction between spheres, or we have negative pressure, I should say, which is very closely related to attraction between spheres in a confined system. Can also break this pressure down into its three components. It's sometimes intuitively good to do that. Sometimes it just confuses more because you can't change one without changing all of them, so they're sort of interconnected. But you can see here the dotted line is the thermal contribution, which is just a straight line in this log-log plot. You have a hardcore contribution, which is the solid line, and then you have the negative electrostatic contribution, which is the dash dotted line. And the dash dotted line is always, is that correct? Yeah. The dash dotted line basically follows this thermal one, so what it tells us is that it's not quite the scaling that I said it was before, and the reason for that is that it's not an extreme mean field, of course, but at least it gives you some, the argument I made before should give some kind of vague intuition. So that was the sphere exercise. What is more in line with what people have been talking about today are rods in counter-ion solution. And exactly the same exercise we go through. Here we have a rod. We have a bunch of counter-ions. Counter-ions belonging to the rod, so the total system is charge neutral. Again, going back to all the potentials we had from before, we can evaluate what the total energy of a system is with rods. It's a lot easier than with spheres because the rods are just the 2D thing to begin with. But the main thing to realize here is that, sure, see if I can find that again, is to realize that a logarithmic interaction doesn't really contribute very strongly to a pressure calculation. And the reason is that the log has no scale. But go back to this view graph that we had from before. This is the interaction energy between two particles separated by y and x in coordinates in a system that's Lx times Ly in the two dimensions. You'll notice that if we make a uniform compression or an isotropic compression in x and y of a box like the one I had here, that one, then the ratio between y and ly is constant, and the ratio between x and lx is constant because they all contract with the same ratio, which means that if you make the derivative du d area, x and y, then you get zero. Okay? All these ratios don't depend on the area. They're only ratios. That means that all interaction energies, all interaction between a rod and anything else will drop out from the pressure calculation. And only the self-energy, which for a rod turns out to be this, the self-energy turns out to be this, and you're going to get that from this exercise, from the Lechner summation. Only this term here depends on on the area. So when you do the usual du, the area, for the, because it's a 2D object, the only electrostatic pressure contribution you get from the logarithmic part of your interaction is simply the self-energies of your logarithmic object, namely the rods. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm always using periodic boundary
conditions. Is the artifact of periodic boundary conditions and logarithmic terms
ballpark? Not really. If you take a log... is it an artifact of the periodic boundary conditions? Oh, thank you. that the interaction energy does not contribute to the thermodynamic pressure. If you take the derivative of a log, you get a 1 over r, okay? If you have the virial, the force will be 1 over r, and you multiply that with r, and you have a constant. That constant, if you add that up to infinity and you assume you have a charge-neutral system, will end up being your self-energy. So it's not an artifact of the periodic boundary conditions. Even if you didn't have periodic boundary conditions, you always see funny things with your logarithmic interactions. That's why I said they didn't have any scale. You get the same pressure contribution regardless of the distance in a logarithmically interacting system. Can you follow me?
I think so. I think if you're modeling a finite length filament, because you're really modeling an infinitely long.
It's infinite. If it's finite, it's not a log anymore.
That's right. That's
then, yeah. So it has to be. It has to be ideal. Yeah. I'm sorry.
If you're modeling regression between two twin cylinders, mm-hmm. then you have to have two of them in your unit cell.
Uh huh. Yeah. If I want to find the interaction between two cylinders, I need to have two cylinders in my box.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're not doing that calculation.
Not right now.
You're calculating a pressure and arguing that a negative pressure sort of in some way corresponds.
What I'll eventually argue for is that electrostatic contributions will always give attraction. It's all the other things that'll give you repulsion. It comes consistently out of these calculations here. The electrostatic contribution to the total pressure is always negative for these systems. It's this term and that term that kills that negativity, but they're always there.
And the electrostatic is always computed using charge.
If you look at this calculation, it's always a uniform background charge. If you look at this calculation as a self-energy for an isolated object, and you don't consider the countercharges as particles, then there is implicitly assumed in the formalism that it must be a uniform background. However, if you look at the entire system with all its particles and you add all the contributions up, all those neutral backgrounds cancel each other, and you actually see the truly summed up interaction. Sure. All right. So here we have some simulations, and I'll just skate through them. Basically, this is one rod in a orthorhombic system. It's periodic in all directions, and the one rod is, of course, replicated in two, and the particles are replicated in three dimensions. And if we take a rod charge density of minus E over 2 angstrom, which is, I don't know why I picked that, it was just a nice number. And if you then throw in all the counter ions as being monovalent in the system, you measure the pressure as a function of the distance that's basically being one dimension of this box in the x or y direction. It's a square in the x and y direction. If you plot that, then you get a nice purely repulsive curve like this. So if this calculation was correct and if this system was a good system, that would actually correspond somewhat to Rudy Podgornik's systems, except I don't have any salt here. But of course it doesn't, because I don't have all the flexibility that Rudy was talking about. However, if we then add more and more divalent ions, so we take out some monovalent counter ions and we put in divalent instead, so we take two monovalent out for each divalent we put in, we move down this curve, and at some point it flips over and it becomes negative. So when we have full divalent contribution to the counter ion composition, there is a nice short range negative pressure, which I would associate with an attractive force. And if it's purely monovalent, it's always repulsive. That's for a certain size. You can also take and vary the size of the rod. So let's say we pick this curve here and we say there are only divalent counter ions. As we vary the size, the radius of the rod, we can erode this attractive component simply by pushing. Obviously, the rods can't get closer than a certain distance, so if that distance is beyond the negative or the positive part of this slope here, obviously we don't have any bundling anymore. So the pressure again here will always be positive if the rod is fat enough.
But you have a constant line charge.
Have a constant line charge.
Which means that the equivalent surface charge is actually decreasing.
Yeah. Yeah. But basically, what I'm saying here is, if you have a fatter rod, you should have more repulsion. There are very fat rods in biology, but the line charge density is usually not going beyond, you know, the usual DNA parameters. I won't talk about the other ones right now. I'll wait with this. If we take something that's closer to what people have been talking about this morning, so we take a charge density of minus E over 1.7 angstrom, which is a DNA line charge density, sort of just uniformly distributed along the rod. We have a rod radius we'll pick arbitrarily to about 11. I don't know exactly what these parameters should be. And then we put that in a box. We put in monovalent ions, then we get the curve from before. It's basically purely repulsive. If we put in trivalent, it is very strongly attractive, negative tensile pressure. If it's divalent for DNA parameters in this primitive model, it's very marginal. And that's, first of all, it's in agreement with simulations that Lubotsev and his group did some years ago. But it's actually very nice, because I think the experiments actually do show that this is a marginal case, that there are most of the divalent counter ions that you put in cannot give, oh, still a few minutes.
Yeah, we're in discussion.
Yeah. Cannot give attraction, but there may be one that can. But this basically tells you that it's a marginal case. So, two more minutes and then I'll stop. You can also, this is for a system that looks like that, so that's replicated like this, so it's a very idealized system. You can also pick a unit cell that looks like this or looks like that and investigate if you made any significant errors. And in having the periodicity. And basically, the result here is that if you take all the different unit cells with more or less rods in them, all that kind of stuff, you basically get the same answer. And that's kind of interesting, first of all, because it does give confidence to the results that we just got, but it also tells you that you can get this thermodynamic parameter from an incredibly small system. You basically only need one rod and a few counter ions, and you get the same pressure as if you have four rods and a lot more counter ions. Here I've broken down the pressure into the hard core, the thermal, and the electrostatic. And I've done that for a couple of different counter ion valencies. This one here is the trivalent. The different components are almost identical. And here I've done it for the monovalent. And again, they're almost identical. The electrostatic contribution is almost unimpressed with what the valency of the counter ions are. That's kind of cute. Not only are they almost completely unimpressed with it, the dashed line here is the analytic expression I had from a single rod, the self-energy of a single rod. So that's an analytic expression. We also have the thermal contribution. That, of course, increases with the number of counter ions. So for monovalent, you have more counter ions, and therefore the thermal contribution is higher. As you increase the valency, that will go down. So that leaves a big difference, but that's still a completely predictable thing. And then there's the hard core, which this is the monovalent, that's divalent, and that's the trivalent. And here you can see the correlation effect. The trivalent basically comes in and makes this little wiggle here, which is a correlation effect, basically sharing the counter ions between the rods. But basically the message here is that the electrostatic contribution is always negative. electrostatics has to collapse. I mean, that's what charge-neutral systems do. The hard core is almost, I mean, there's a little wiggle here, but basically that's also the same to a rough approximation. What makes the whole difference is the number of counter ions, and that's what makes the pressure go positive or negative. And the fine balance between these three numbers is what makes the total pressure. So, as usual, I could talk for another hour or two, but I'll stop here.
Thank you.
I don't know. I haven't done much of planes, mainly because there's been so much work on planes, and probably that should be the reason why I should connect it.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't, no.
Yeah, but you made the comment about sharing counter ions.
Uh-huh.
And what does that mean with respect to charge neutrality?
If they share the counter, what I mean by sharing counter ions is that you have to have two objects of one charge, and you have the other object in between. It's kind of like a salt bridge. So if you separate them, there'll obviously be counter ions glued on one of them and glued on the other. If you push them together, those two layers will be a single layer, just like the Wigner crystal for two plates. When you get them close enough together, they actually share everything in between, and that's the correlation effect that I believe Rufina and Blumfeld quite beautifully demonstrated a few years ago in a paper.
And what would you expect to happen if you put a charge distribution on the cylinder?
Yeah, if I put a charge distribution, basically all the phosphorus groups of the DNA, for example. For DNA, I don't think I would see a big difference, and the reason I say that is that Lyubartsev didn't see a big difference when he tried it. However, I think it's very, very important if you want to study other biopolymers like actin or microtubules, because they actually contradict these predictions completely. They have lower line charge density and they're fatter, but they condense a lot easier with divalent counter ions. There's a paper, I believe that's a Jan May paper from a few years ago that shows some light scattering experiments on that. And that's probably because the idealized model is no good. You have to get the surface and all the details into play. If it's monovalent, I can't make the pressure go negative, unless I make the sphere very, very small. So if I have to stay at surface charge densities that are reasonable, you know, need divalent. They did or did not?
They did.
They did, yeah, okay. So they predated Lyubartsev. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
It erodes completely. It erodes completely. This is slightly different, but that's basically just looking at two rods in a system. If you look at the effective force between the two rods and you look at the minimum value of that force, when it's attractive, actually I should show the other one here. When it's attractive, that minimum is of course negative. So that's an attractive force. If you look at that point here, you take the absolute value and you plot it as a function of temperature. So when this here is positive, you have an attractive force. When you increase temperature, it basically erodes this attraction completely. And that's, of course, in contrast to the Osawa argument. It doesn't come back up again. I haven't seen that.
Final question on this. you try to convince us to use Lechner sums for the electrostatic interaction. But on the other hand, you only so far simulated very small systems. What are the biggest systems you really looked at? And when you compare it to the standard modern particle mesh Evald code, where do you expect that the particle mesh code is digital linear and the number of particles compared to the way you look at it, which I think was in squares.
Oh, yeah, it's still in squared.
Where does it cross?
It probably crosses at about 1,000 particles. The Lechner method, you can easily make that into a multiple type of method, and that would basically scale like N as well. I think the papers on the particle mesh said that it takes about 1,000 particles, and then it's advantageous to use the particle mesh. Isn't that correct? Oh, yeah? Okay. But I'm basically using very, very small systems. It's not a...